This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll hear from Beltway-based investigative reporter Dan Moldea, the writer who broke stories to change the political futures of Louisiana politicos Bob Livingston and David Vitter. Dan Moldea will speculate on the mystery surrounding the anonymous op-ed piece about President Trump from a high-ranking member of his administration, and also where is the nomination to the Supreme Court of Brett Kavanaugh going? Some intense hearings by the Judiciary Committee this week. Actress Denise Boutte is slated to be with us, a graduate of the LSU Manship School. She has a flourishing career in Hollywood that she will discuss. An amputee bicyclist, Nikki Raylon, a native of Germany, will comment on her trip that is ongoing from San Francisco to Key West with a stop in Baton Rouge. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. And we start our conversation with Dan Moldea, the celebrated investigative reporter who has been with us a few times. And Dan Moldea, from his perch in the Beltway, has had an interesting week, as this has been a week like few others, even in the era of Donald John Trump and the president. Right now, of course, is obsessed with trying to find the leaker in his office, the one who wrote the anonymous op-ed piece to the New York Times. Last night, he went to the hustings in the great state of Montana. He appeared to make light of a Montana politician's assault on a reporter last year during a rally in Billings. The president praised Greg Gianforte, a current House Republican lawmaker who is a congressional candidate, assaulted a reporter from The Guardian during an interview on the campaign trail. According to the president, I tell you what, this man has fought in more ways than one for your state. He's fought for your state. The president said, Greg Gianforte, he's a fighter and a winner. Dan Moldea, the age of Trump has brought new meaning to the discourse of American politics. What do you think about where we are right now as we speak?
Is this a great country or what? I it's Ripley's, man. I mean, it's every single day there's a new surprise, there's a new outrage, there's a new America, and people are baffled by it. The this week with Bob Woodward's, I had some news that I was bringing to the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, and I was completely overwhelmed by this very important news from Bob Woodward's new book, his upcoming new book, which will be out next Tuesday. As well as, the anonymous op-ed in the New York Times, which everyone is speculating, who was the person who's responsible for this? And, of course, there's this dragnet going on over at the White House right now where they're trying to find out, discover who the traitor is in their midst. And the best analogy I've heard so far is that Trump is acting like Captain Queeg and that film where he, turned the ship upside down looking for who ate the extra helping of strawberries. It's a crazy time here in Washington, but it's been like that for the past 18 months since this guy became president.
Well, Mike Pence, according to Las Vegas oddsmakers, is the most likely source of the op-ed piece.
I would bet it would be somebody on his staff. That's been my bet, because they really emphasize the 25th Amendment in the letter in the op-ed, and certainly the people on Pence's staff would have knowledge of the 25th Amendment.
And the word lodestar is used, and that is a word that Pence uses frequently, and not one that we hear that often.
I wasn't aware of that, Jim. Thanks for telling me that. That's a good clue. Yeah, that's a very good clue. I'll be curious to see whether the New York Times puts a group of reporters on the news side to investigate what's happening on the New York Times op-ed side to see whether they can discover who was behind this. If anyone could do it, the New York Times certainly could.
877-217-5757 is your number for Dan Moldea. He is in Washington in the midst of all this, and if you'd like to send us an email, you can also do the email version, talk@talklouisiana.org. And, Dan Moldea, as we look at the situation, you said you had new evidence or new information about Brett Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court nominee. I see two op-ed pieces in the New York Times today, one from the Nobel Prize-winning laureate Paul Krugman, the other from Sean Willits, and both of them indicate that Kavanaugh was obsessed with believing that Vince Foster was murdered. This was when he was working for Ken Starr. And you, of course, have totally debunked that. The man committed suicide on July 20th, 1993. What about Kavanaugh's obsession with this?
Well, that's how I got to know him. I had I was finishing my book on the suicide of Vince Foster, and I was hearing that the that Ken Starr and his office of the Independent Counsel were getting ready to come out with a report about Foster's death, and the timing was I was going to turn in my book, and then this report was going to come out before my book came out, and I didn't want my book to be dead on arrival, so I went to Starr's people to really just to make sure that my book was timely and fair and accurate. I wasn't looking for trouble. I wasn't looking for grand jury information or anything like that. So I went to Hickman Ewing. Starr had two top deputies, Hickman Ewing and Jackie Bennett. So I went to Hickman Ewing first, and he told me, well, you know, we will give you non-public information on an off-the-record basis if we know where you're coming from and Ken Starr personally approves of you. And he said, we've got this guy named Brett Kavanaugh, and we'll introduce him to you, and he will, you know, provide you with information. So for one reason or another, that did not happen. So I went to the other deputy, Jackie Bennett, and Jackie Bennett was saying, well, if you need substantive information, I can give you the substantive information personally. He kept on using that phrase, substantive information, and I can arrange this and I can introduce you. So he said he would. So the next thing I know, I'm getting a call from Brett Kavanaugh. And so we had a brief conversation just to set up a lunch on January 19th, 1998, like hours before the Lewinsky scandal broke. And during that conversation, it was off the record. My conversation with Ewing, my conversation with Bennett were both on the record. In fact, I tape recorded both conversations. And then my conversation with Brett Kavanaugh is off the record. So I had given Senate Judiciary Committee came to me because I had written an affidavit to the court back in August of 1998. With regard to the leaks investigation that was going on by Judge Norma Holloway Johnson. And so the committee came to me, and they saw a docket on the docket of the leaks investigation. Document number 61 was affidavit from Danny Moldea. So they said, who the hell is this guy? So they clicked it, and they saw that it was a journalist who was talking about the leaks coming out of the OIC. And so they came to me. They asked me if I would surrender the tapes, which I did, and then they didn't use them in the hearings with Kavanaugh, but they but Senator Whitehouse from Rhode Island yesterday in his questioning, both in the second and third round, challenged Kavanaugh to give a waiver to reporters with whom he had off the record conversations, so they could take those conversations and report on what the content of those conversations. What the intent was is that there was illegal leaking coming out of Ken Starr's office. And as you know, Jim, from your experiences, that when a prosecutor's leaking heavily, as was happening during the Starr investigation, pre-Monica Lewinsky, that means they've got a very weak case. And they're trying to turn reporters and journalists into shills and stalking horses, trying to recruit them to feed them information from them their sources who are refusing to speak directly to the prosecutors. And that's what Starr's operation was. It was a massive leaks operation. It was a massive smear campaign against the Clintons until Monica Lewinsky, when they actually had a case. And that's kind of what happened. And Brett Kavanaugh was at the epicenter of all of that. So accompanying the tapes that I gave to the committee, I also gave an affidavit, which augmented my affidavit from 20 years ago about what had happened since and what was happening now.
877-217-5757 for Dan Moldea, the investigative reporter who changed the political course of Bob Livingston and David Vitter in Louisiana for Newt Gingrich. He is an intrepid reporter, and of course right now Washington has a lot of stories that have layers of activity, and certainly the president wants to know who is spilling the beans on him in the New York Times. And Rand Paul, a libertarian, Dan Moldea, he is calling for everybody on the White House staff to take a lie detector test. What do you make of this?
Well, it's going to get kind of draconian. I mean, again, it's Trump is obsessed with that he has traitors all around him. Who do you think it is, Jim? What's your best guess?
I don't know, but I think I don't know. But I hate to speculate, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's somebody you wouldn't think, like Kellyanne Conway.
There's a lot of speculation about Kellyanne Conway, especially since her husband, George Conway, is such a big critic of Trump. There are images of the movie The Untouchables where Al Capone finds the two informants at that dinner, and then he takes a baseball bat to them. I would hate to be that person. Although, you know, Trump really doesn't do much of the dirty work himself. He sort of delegates it. And so I would assume, and I'm sure you'd agree with this, that sooner or later, whoever Anonymous is, he's going to reveal him or herself and get a seven-figure book contract, and will wind up on 60 Minutes, and will experience life, a new life after having a tragic experience working with the Trump administration.
Right. Catherine Wells writes, the New York Times has said they know who the high-level official is. I'm sure that's the case. Otherwise, they would not have printed this. But
right.
The Times is not releasing his identity, writes Catherine. She also adds the word lodestar is a military term. And so some people are speculating General Kelly. It could be Kelly. Could be a lot of people. But people also could be using words like that to throw the attention on somebody else.
Like Mike Pence.
877-217-5757 for Dan Moldea on Talk Louisiana. And we'll return after this 90-second pause on WRKF.
Is it a palace coup?
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing. Your number is 877-217-5757 in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. Email talk@talklouisiana.org. Dan Moldea is with us, the celebrated investigative reporter who... a listener notes, and Dan would certainly not shy from acknowledging this, he worked for one Larry Flint. He did some work as a journalist for him. And the listener, Tracy, asks if you ever worked for David Pecker of the National Enquirer.
No, I haven't done that. No, I haven't debased myself to that point yet.
What about Pecker getting immunity? This is an interesting development.
Well, him, Trump's attorney, his accountant, the fact that Don McGahn, his White House counsel, had spent 30 hours with the independent counsel. And, I mean, it's remarkable, what's surrounding. I got to hand it to Trump. Obviously, I don't like the guy. But he, I think he's dishonest. I think he's corrupt. I think he's mobbed up. And I think he's a Russian stooge. But I got to hand it to him that I don't know how he's handling this physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. I just don't know how he can handle all this pressure. I mean, it would just crush any normal person. So I got to hand it to him for his stamina, unless the rumors we're hearing that he's just flat out crazy, that he's just out of his mind right now, is true. I mean, I just don't know how he's handling all this pressure. It's just remarkable. And Mueller, that's the beauty of, and that, what I was saying earlier about the prosecutors with weak cases leak. You know, Bob Mueller isn't leaking. There are no leaks coming out of Bob Mueller's shop, which indicates high confidence, which indicates they have cases, which indicates they are moving forward, which means Trump is on the target list.
Well, any man who can survive six bankruptcies and two divorces can handle pressure.
Right.
And Trump, that may be his greatest gift, is that he can, as Muhammad Ali could, he can take a punch, not a literal punch, but when it comes to
right.
having these various investigations, he is staying the course at a time when others might crumble. Remember Gary Hart, who I really
sure.
liked a lot and has been a guest on this show. He got out of the race, I think, because he felt guilty about his
right.
relationship with Donna Rice. Trump could right. care less about Right. Stormy Daniels or any
absolutely
of the others.
Shameless, yeah. She's shameless. And his supporters love him for it. They love him. They as long as he continues the race war against the poor and the powerless and gives people their guns and pretends to have a deep affection for God and Jesus, his supporters will continue to support him. But he's sort of wrecking a lot of things right now. And if the Democrats don't win at least the House in the midterms, I mean, you know, we're looking at a whole new ball game here in this country. We're looking about a highly centralized executive, and the Republicans have absolutely no backbone to stand up to this guy because they don't want to go up against the base, which is supporting him with a 90% approval rating, which is breathtaking in and of itself. And, I mean, these people may not be racist themselves, but it certainly shows that being a racist isn't a game changer for them. It's going to be remarkable to see what happens. I saw something the other day that was the biggest surprise, not that Donald Trump was such a surprise in and of itself. What's the real surprise is how our fellow country people have reacted to this, where they've embraced this guy. So, again, the elections are about elections have consequences, so let's see what happens in November. And let's see what happens with Bob Mueller, who I have a lot of hope for. I have a feeling that Bob Mueller is light years away from us. I have a feeling Bob Mueller is going to turn us all into jelly when he comes out with his report, when we discover the extent of the corruption of this administration. And I think that I have high hopes for what Mueller is going to do. The question is, what would the Republican-controlled Congress do with it?
All right. Well, I must note, Dan Mulday is obviously a voice from the left. A few weeks ago, we heard from Bob Livingston, the aforementioned former congressman who was almost Speaker of the House, who said in his view there isn't a scintilla of evidence that Donald Trump was involved in any sort of collusion with the Russians. And next week, we will hear from some other conservative voices, including former Congressman Henson Moore of Baton Rouge. 877-217-5757. Tom in Woodland Ridge. Tom, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Fine.
Good. A sort of a philosophical or business ethics question for you and your guest regarding the New York Times op-ed. A bunch of folks, almost all of the people in the administration that you would consider to be upper level, have set out public denials that they were not the authors of this. The New York Times, assuming one of them is not telling the truth, the New York Times knows that that person is publicly lying. Is that not news that the New York Times has some obligation to print?
All right, that's a good question. Thank you, Tom.
I think it's a very good question. I really don't know. I don't know what's happening inside the New York Times right now. I don't know what they're... Listen, there's a lot of desperation right now. I mean, you have Trump declaring the media to be, you know, the enemy of the people, and as Jim opened his show up today about violence against, he's praising violence against reporters. We're in a situation here where, you know, the media is feeling their back up against the wall, and, you know, when you're like that, you make mistakes. So let's see how the Times vindicates itself on this. I don't know who this person is. I would assume it's a senior level person, as the Times has claimed. I believe the New York Times because it is the New York Times, just as I believe Bob Woodward because Bob Woodward is Bob Woodward. But I have to say that the denials are breathtaking on both of these things, both with Anonymous and with Bob Woodward. And I'll be curious to see how all of this plays out.
Brad in Sherwood. Hi, Brad. You're on the air with Talk Louisiana and Dan Moldea. Hi, Brad. Good
morning, all. I just wanted to react to some of the positions that Dan was bringing up today. You know, I understand the way that we're pushing this, but what's interesting is when we're talking about racism and everything else, a lot of what Trump has said and embraced was pretty much the same policy that Bill Clinton had, and there was no distancing from Hillary. And where I'm going with this is, you know, if we have a racist in office, so to speak, we would have had a racist in office the other way around. We would have had a sexist in office the other way around.
I don't think I don't think Bill Clinton and Donald Trump would agree about Charlottesville, for example, where Donald Trump said there's good people on both sides, you know, and he's specifically referring to people wearing swastikas and doing the Hitler salute down the streets of Charlottesville. That's the kind of racism I'm talking about.
Well, and Bill Clinton was at Aretha Franklin's funeral as a eulogist. Some call him the first black president. He obviously has great affinity for African Americans and its return, but at the same time, he is a man of his times. And according to Ted Kennedy, he said of Barack Obama when Ted Kennedy endorsed Obama instead of Hillary Clinton in 2008, said if it were 20 years ago, he would be serving us coffee. And Ted Kennedy was offended by that. So sometimes you have to view the context. Now, Trump, he had a two-year relationship with an African-American woman, Kara Young, and he I don't think he's a racist. Some do. But he has policies that may in some ways mimic Bill Clinton, but he also has views which in some ways mimic those of one David Ernest Duke, who ran for governor and U.S. senator here in Louisiana.
Right. I agree. The proof is in the pudding, and to me Charlottesville was a litmus test on this. And when he had a chance to back off on Charlottesville the next day, he doubled down on it. And to me that was pretty much all she wrote at that point. But your caller, I understand the point. I respect that. We're dealing with a dishonest guy here. I mean, the Washington Post clocks these things. They count the number of lies that Trump has told. And in the first 18 months in office, it was like 4,555 provable, documented lies that he would tell. I mean, at what point do the lies that Trump is telling cause us a national security problem? And
we're going to return with Dan Moldea. Your number is 297-5633 in Baton Rouge, 877-217-5757 everywhere else, and now the news.
It's 9:30
Southern Radio Network.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757, and talk at talklouisiana.org is our email. And Dan Moldea is with us for a bit longer, and we are told that Denise Boutte, the fine actress from Baton Rouge, who is doing well in Hollywood, will step aside and let Dan Boldea go a little longer, since we have so many people who are interested in questioning him and offering insights about what's going on with the 45th American president, Donald John Trump. 877-217-5757. Brad, excuse me, this is Al in... I'm not sure about the location, Al. Where are you?
I'm in Lydia, Louisiana.
Okay. Lydia,
Louisiana. Down here by the Gulf.
Well, very good. You're on Talk Louisiana, Al.
Okay. What if President Trump is creating smoke screens to cloak his deals and business secrets? Don't we all deserve some privacy? I think that's how he feels. And if you muddy up the waters, who can see the truth? And I think that's what's going on here, and that we need someone smart like him, maybe to get this country out of the mess it's in. You know, I don't know. I don't agree with everything he says and his actions, but that notwithstanding, the question I beg the question, you know, is he creating a smokescreen, cover up his business deals? Don't we all deserve some privacy?
I think that's a good question. I think that he... You know, with regard to, the smoke screens, I mean, you know, we're kind of in a full disclosure, you know, mode here where we should be, you know, disclosing things. Presidents, we should know what presidents are doing, what motivates them, what they're doing, how they're making their money. I mean, I don't think these are unreasonable questions. I mean, this is the first president that hasn't revealed his income tax returns. And I think that, you know, there has to be some sort of a standard here for full disclosure when it comes to the presidency, and this guy isn't disclosing. With regard to him being so smart, remember, this guy has been called an idiot, by his chief of staff. He was called a moron by his secretary of state, his ex-secretary of state, his foreign policy advisor in the White House. He was also called him a moron. I mean, you know, General Mattis, a very respected military leader, our Secretary of Defense, said that he thinks at the level of a fifth or sixth grader. I mean, you know, this guy may not be the sharpest knife in the drawer. And as Jim pointed out earlier, this guy has six bankruptcies to his credit. And during the campaign, he bragged about that he's the king of debt. And despite all the protests of the Republicans and how they were all claiming, oh, we're so much trouble over our budget deficit, they have supercharged the deficit since they've been in office with this ridiculous tax reform bill, so-called tax reform bill, which is nothing more than a soak the poor tax, which is going to wind up busting out the American economy, just like a mafia family busting out a local savings and loan.
All right. There are so many stories about the president that it's hard to keep track, and any day there is a story buried within the pages of the New York Times or other newspapers that would be front page any other time. Here's one on page A14, 2 weeks ago, August 24th. Stay dies criminal case against Trump's company. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office is considering pursuing criminal charges against the Trump Organization and two senior company officials in connection with Michael Cohen's hush money payment to an adult film actress, according to two officials with knowledge of the matter. Now, Dan Moldea, if a state court goes after the president, then he has some problems. Even if he pardons himself, he still would have exposure in his home state of New York.
Well, yeah, in any state the states don't recognize the federal pardon, the presidential pardon. So if he were to pardon Michael Cohen in New York or any of the other underlings anyplace else where they're indicted, whether it's Delaware, Pennsylvania, here in Washington, whatever. They're still in trouble because states don't recognize the presidential pardon.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Good morning, Phil. You're on Talk Louisiana with Dan Moldea.
Good morning, sir. I think if Bill Clinton crossed the runway to climb up into an airplane and visit with his attorney general was on, and then the Republicans raised living glorious hell about that. Maybe that's what needs to happen to our president, that he needs to be caught with somebody. I mean, this, you could fill a yearbook with the transgressions of this party. I mean, they have.
I agree. And the transgressions, which is a very good word, that you point out, I mean, they are, you know, which were pointed out on an individual basis. I mean, Barack Obama, you know, we're talking about a man who was so dignified and classy and such a good family man and a role model and you know, in my opinion, probably the best president of my lifetime. Donald Trump is such an antithesis to this. And the way he takes his personal when you talk about the president's dishonesty, they'll say, "Oh, Barack Obama, he said, oh, well, you can, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor." And they're saying that that was a lie. And again, ignoring the 4,555 documented lies that have been proven about Donald Trump since he took office in January 9th of 2017. So, you know, we're beyond the looking glass on this one, where, you know, his supporters will forgive him anything and everything, whether it's paying off a porn star, cheating on all three of his wives, whatever. There are conflicting standards of private behavior for public officials, one for those they like and another for those they don't like. But we've become so tribal now that, you know, I used to be, and Jim knows this, I used to be right down the middle on these things. And I was radicalized back in 1998, I guess, when I published my book on the Vince Foster suicide, which the right-wing media, hiding under the guise of the First Amendment, were, you know, basically trying to claim was a murder which had been orchestrated by Bill and Hillary Clinton. And that radicalized me because I saw an attempt to overthrow the executive branch of the United States government by this cabal of right-wingers who were trying to throw anything and everything against the president. And they had a prosecutorial goon squad in the name of Ken Starr's Office of Independent Counsel, of which Brett Kavanaugh was part of the, or at least he was the designated leaker, who was trying to compromise reporters in the process, which is where we started this conversation.
Terry Ryder asks, do you think the Mueller investigation is legitimate? And some would say this is a ridiculous question, but if you watch Fox News, Sean Hannity has been saying it's illegitimate from the start. Rudy Giuliani has basically implied the same thing. And the president, of course, says this is a witch hunt. What do you think, Dan?
You know, Fox News is the whorehouse of American journalism. I mean, let's face it. I mean, it's more of a political operation than it is a news operation, although there's some very fine reporters there, I guess. You know, they have – this is the – it's remarkable in that you have a television network, you know, which starts with Fox and Friends, which is the president's favorite show, where he takes – members of his administration. It's sort of like a minor leagues for his administration. He will pick and choose people from Fox News to come and join his administration. There has to be some hesitance to do it because of all the news that's coming out of the White House right now as to how dysfunctional the White House is.
All right. Here's another question from a listener. This is Hal in Monroe, who's listening at WRKF.org. He asks about this policy that the National Enquirer had of catch and kill, in which they would take stories like the relationship Trump had with the Playboy playmate Karen right. McDougal, and then not publish them. Is that he asked if that's commonly done in journalism?
It's an outrage. It's a complete outrage. Just as if Robert Mueller was leaking with the same frequency as Ken Starr did way back when Brett Kavanaugh was his designated leaker, there would be, Fox News, we'd be scraping them off the walls right now. We would be scraping the Republican majority off the walls right now because, you know, but again, there are these conflicting standards of private behavior for public officials, one for those you like and one for those you don't like. And so the Republicans will turn their back, and they will allow their people, especially Donald Trump, to get along, to go along, to be, you know, scot-free in these situations that nobody else would be. They don't hold Donald Trump to the same standards they hold everybody else to. The religious right, take them for example. I mean, how the hell can they continue to support this guy?
Well, he's giving them good judges, according to Gene Mills, the Family
That's
Forum.
That's a fact. Excellent point, Jim. That's exactly right.
And last night I saw Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana on Chris Cuomo's show on CNN, and I don't think there's any doubt that John Kennedy is voting for Brett Kavanaugh. Anything other than him saying that would be untrue. He's voting for him, and so is Bill Cassidy. And my guess is that all the Republicans will. But is there a possibility that, say, Susan Collins, one of the so-called moderate Republicans, will have a change of heart?
Well, let's see what – I mean, this document has come out where Brett Kavanaugh has questioned in very stark terms, you know, indicating that he would probably vote against Roe versus Wade. Let's see how that affects Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays. Also, there was some material about Alaska that came out that could have offended Murkowski. And I think the Democrats have sort of done a pretty good job of picking certain issues with the intention of just trying to get one or two, they're going to have to get two Republican senators to vote no. If they can get two senators to vote no, then they've got something here. Remember, in the old days, it took 60 votes to get a Supreme Court nominee confirmed. Now, through committee, through the Congress, through the Senate.
Okay. Dan, we got a roll, but it's always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us, my friend, and we'll be back after this pause.
I'm Tim Franks.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana. And in studio with us is one of the most remarkable guests we'll ever encounter, Nikki Raylan. She is from Berlin, and she is an avid athlete and bicyclist, but her story is one of immense courage and recovery. Not so long ago, in November 1, 2013, she was in an accident that would have killed many people, and it's made a profound impact on her. But she has come back in a big way. She's bicycling from San Francisco all the way to Key West, and she is in Baton Rouge. She's about halfway to her final destination. But her book is Push On, My Walk to Recovery on the Appalachian Trail. And good morning to you, Nikki Raylan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's good to have you at the microphone. And you are a fascinating story. And when I say it was a near-death event almost 5 years ago, there's no doubt that you were right at the edge.
Exactly.
What happened?
Well, I was rappelling, and I came off harness, and I free fall 45 feet. So what happened was I was canyoneering with friends at Lake Powell, Utah, and I didn't double-check my harness. And that's also a reason why I wrote that book, Push On, My Walk to Recovery. It's a memoir, and telling people you never can often check enough your gear and your settings. As a skydiver, we always double-check each other our gear, and scuba diving as well. Canyoneering is a kind of a new sport, and routine was not kind of developed. And so it's like a good message to spread around to tell, always double check.
Mm-hmm. And you lost a leg.
Well, I came off harness the remaining of 45 feet, landed first on my left leg, shattered my pelvis, my spine, all my ribs, my sternum, my middle finger as well. And not even had a kind of concussion, because my ski helmet saved pretty much my life, because the ski helmet was cracked in the center, so I was pretty lucky.
And then you had an amazing recovery. You were determined to come back. In the early going, I'm sure survival was first and foremost, but when you crossed that line, you decided you were going to be competitive in another realm. What happened?
Well, I was hospitalized for 4 months, and so I got hooked up with all this medication they want to give me. Good thing I'm a paramedic and EMT basic, so I didn't want to listen to all these advices what doctors was trying to push on me. And so I didn't pull myself into that addiction of opiates and maybe becoming a heroin addict. So I did my own physical therapy after I was released out of the hospital. The first part of the rehabilitation was motorbiking from Colorado all the way to Florida, because I was invited for my brother's wedding. And then I was back in Germany. I did my own rehab by bicycling 4 hours a day, going to my old swim team, hiking around the neighborhood, and actually worked out every single day between 6 and 8 hours. People thinking 3 days, three times a week doing physical therapy, that's part of the therapy afterwards. I didn't thought so, and that's one of the reasons why I was able, just 14 months later, 1-4, to hike the entire length of the Appalachian Trail. That is called my walk to recovery. I had only 40% leg strength. I was being told, because of the severe pelvic injury, that I have severe nerve damage, that maybe I cannot contract my quads not any more longer. And I didn't want to believe that kind of news, and I decided, mind over matter. I proved already myself when I was a teenager, I did triathlons. When I was having a bad accident, bicycle accident, I broke my neck and my back, and I was already, at that time, hospitalized. And I was being told that I will have back pain for the rest of my life. So I overcome that already when I was a teenager, and then this accident
all right, so
as well.
You broke your neck when you were a teenager.
Yeah, exactly.
Which vertebrae?
It was the thoracic area, the spine, and then in my neck. I was super lucky. I was getting becoming a quadriceps.
Yeah, well, you overcame that, and then you have this accident in Utah, and you went through this so quickly, I'm not sure I absorbed it. 14 months after the accident, in which you were almost killed with severe injuries, including losing much of your left leg, 14 months later, you're hiking the Appalachian Trail. How long is that?
It's 2,200 miles. It goes from Georgia all the way up to Maine. And I became the first female who hiked the entire length of the Appalachian Trail on a prosthetic leg.
An amazing feat. And all of this has happened within the last 5 years. And I stated your current mission. You started riding in San Francisco. Which route did you take? Did you go through California or did you...
Yeah, of course, San Francisco. So the reason why I started up north, because I love the Pacific Coast Highway.
Yes.
I already bicycled in 2002 when I came the first time to North America, from Vancouver all the way up to Alaska, all the way down to Mexico City. So I really looked forward to bicycle the Pacific Coast Highway again, all the way down to Los Angeles. And then I picked up Route 66 all the way to Oklahoma City. And from Oklahoma City, I started going south. And that's the reason I'm here in Baton Rouge.
This is amazing. May I ask how old you are?
Oh, no. every morning when I see myself in the mirror, I'm meeting a new person.
Well, you look fabulous, but you're not a kid, and you've had these injuries. I mean, we're talking severe injuries, a broken neck and loss of part of your left leg, and you're riding all over the country. How long is this odyssey taking?
Well, it's a journey. It's not a destination. So that's also a story in my book about life as a journey in general. And when I met people on a Pacific Crest Trail or an Appalachian Trail, it was all about them, especially for the young kids, just to get there. I think it's more important to smell the roses along the way. And it's the same for me right now when I'm bicycling right now across the country. I had a chance to stay with my friends here in Baton Rouge who met me the first time when I bicycled the Southern Road coast to coast. I bicycled in 2010 from the East Coast all the way to the West Coast. And I stayed with friends at that time here, and now I stayed again with the same people eight years later.
When did you start in San Francisco?
June 6.
June 6.
Yeah.
So here we are 3 months later, and you're in Baton Rouge.
Right.
And I guess by December, you'll be completed?
Well, I take my time. If I have more opportunity doing book signings along the way and people like to invite me, that's priority number one.
All right. Well, the book is Push On, My Walk to Recovery on the Appalachian Trail. And if ever there is a story about heroism, this is it. And this has all happened within the last 5 years. And many people would have quit. But you did not. You have done things that people who are whole usually don't do. In Germany, people are in generally better shape than they are in the United States. And when I say generally, remarkably better shape. Why do you think the U.S. is a nation of people who are largely not in good physical condition?
Well, Europe is more congested. It's less space. And the privilege you guys have, you have so much open space. You can have a huge shopping malls. You can park right in front of the store. You Europeans, we have to walk to get our stuff done. So I think being brought up in the 70s and 80s, now I can figure out how old I am. Anyway, I had to walk every day, 3 miles round trip to school and back from school. So when you're being taught as a young kid already to use your body every day by walking 3 miles, I think you're getting started to being physical more kind of active. Well, the one doctor who cut off my leg, did the amputation, he was in denial. He could not believe that I did it 14 months later.
Congratulations on what's happened thus far over the last 5 years, and good luck the rest of the way on your route to Key West. Thank you, Nikki. Nikki Raylon, a fascinating lady. Her book is Push On, My Walk to Recovery on the Appalachian Trail. Yesterday, we lost the celebrated movie actor Burt Reynolds. He was a football star at Florida State University in the 1950s, became a big movie star. Nobody was bigger than Burt Reynolds in the late 70s. Today, the New York Times has his obituary full page, B16. If it were 40 years ago, it would have been A1. It starts this way: Burt Reynolds, the wryly, appealing Hollywood heartthrob who carried on a long love affair with moviegoers, even though his performances were more often more memorable than the films that contained them, died on Thursday in Jupiter, Florida. He was 82. Here is Burt Reynolds 40 years ago in one of his best films, The End, in which he is a terminal cancer patient who decides to take his life by drowning himself and goes out to the Pacific Ocean and then decides he wants to live. Here's how Burt Reynolds handled that.
Help me make it. I'll give you 50% of everything I make. 50%, God. I want to point out that nobody gives 50%. I'm talking gross, God. I think I'm going to make it. You won't regret this, Lord. I'll obey every commandment. I'll see my parents more often. No more cheating in business once I get rid of those 9 acres in the desert. And I'm going to start donating that 10% right away. I know I said 50%, Lord, but 10% to start. If you don't want your 10%, then don't take it. I know it was you that saved me, but it was also you that made me sick.
That was Burt Reynolds, who died yesterday at 82 years old. A full life for Burton Leon Reynolds. A few weeks ago, we were talking about the books from the New York Times bestseller list, and there will be another one coming out Sunday. But on nonfiction, a few weeks ago, it was dominated by books from the right side of the political spectrum. But this week, the number one book is Unhinged by Omarosa Manigault-Newman, of course, a former Donald Trump aide who has turned on him. Number two, The Russian Hoax by Greg Jarrett, the Fox News analyst, makes the case against the FBI investigation into collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. Number three, Liars, Leaks, and Liberals by Jeanine Pirro, the legal analyst and Fox News host, argues in favor of President Trump. Number five is Craig Unger, who was with us a few days ago, House of Trump, House of Putin, the relationship between the current heads of Russia and the United States. We'll be back next week, Monday, same time, same place. Until then, for Matt Doyle, I'm Jim Inkster. Hope you have a great weekend. LSU hosting Southeastern tomorrow, 6 o'clock, Tiger Stadium. We'll be talking about that and more Monday. Until then, stay tuned.
Support for Talk Louisiana.